I'm with James Copnell, the former BBC correspondent for Sudan and South Sudan, ahead of the launch of his book, A Poisonous Thorn in Our Hearts, Sudan and South Sudan's Bitter and Incomplete Divorce. James, first of all, congratulations on finishing the book.
Thank you very much.
At what point in your time as BBC correspondent did you decide to write the book? Was there a specific event or experience that triggered the idea?
I think it was just a combination of a lot of different experiences. And the period when I was in Sudan and South Sudan, actually a lot of really incredible things happening, from the elections in April 2010, which were meant to bring about a democratic transformation but failed to do so, the referendum January 2011, and then, of course, above all, South Sudan splitting away. And I felt that lots of people had written good books about why the South Sudanese would want to split away. But what I wanted to do then from that point on was look at the two countries, the two new countries in a way, or the two new nations after separation, and examine a little bit what kind of countries they were. And actually, those incredible events kept on coming in a way, because you had new wars in South Kordofan and Blue Nile, or at least new old wars, frozen conflicts that were heated up again around the time of separation. You had the continuing war in Darfur. You had inter-ethnic conflicts in South Sudan, clashes between Sudan and South Sudan, including the Hejliege-Panthal outright war, and of course the oil shutdown too, and then the tragic events that we're seeing right now in South Sudan. So it was an incredibly busy period, and I realised that I'd been lucky enough through my job to witness a lot of these things, and I felt it'd be worth recording some of them in a book.
Thinking about what's happened recently since December in South Sudan, how much have you adapted the book in the 2 months since then?
Essentially, I left the book almost unaltered, because I felt that actually explained how we got to that problem, this situation, relatively well. The legacy of decades of war at the time of the United Sudan, the divide and rule tactics of Khartoum that created differences, the tensions within the South Sudanese nation state, the lack of good governance that took us up to there, and above all, really, the political tensions within the SPLM between Riek Machar and Salva Kiir, but also other people as well, Pagan Amum and many others who came to criticise Salva Kiir. But what I did do was I wrote a long afterword on the events of the war. That was written at the beginning of February, the last possible moment before publication, and it covered the events of December and January and gave a first look at what is a new and terrifying civil war.
Hindsight is very useful in these situations, but last month, Toby Lanza, the humanitarian coordinator for the UN in South Sudan, spoke here at Chatham House, and he asked why nobody had predicted that the tensions would erupt into this conflict that we see now that's been so devastating and reopened these deep wounds from the civil war. Did you see it coming? And is it even the role of you as a journalist or correspondent to predict the future in this way?
Well, I think not necessarily as a journalist. You can point to the dangers or the risks, but you don't want to create a sense of inevitability either, because nothing is inevitable. And nothing is inevitable. But I think there were people who predicted what would happen. And certainly, if you read the book, you will see that I felt that there was a serious risk of a conflagration between supporters of Riek Machar, between supporters of Salva Kiir. There was a risk that that would take on an ethnic line. And I think those things were visible and possible and a threat. They weren't inevitable, but the risks were certainly there. And I think a lot of people felt that it would escalate in the run-up to the 2015 elections. And actually what happened was it happened a lot earlier, but it came through the political process. It came through the opposition figures within the SPLM feeling that they were being shut out of the decision-making process and that they weren't able to contest for the leadership of the SPLM. And then we had the events of December the 15th, which of course will be debated for some time to come.
So that's the political element. Talk about the economic side of things for a while. An extract published in The Guardian's development blog of the book, you discussed how South Sudan has in some ways followed the Khartoum model of a centralised development in the capital, Juba, and in the state capitals. Why do you think the SPLM government have copied this model, which they were so keen to separate themselves from?
Yeah, not just economically, I think politically too, in a way. John Garang made his famous speech when he talked about the need to take the towns to the people, and 83% of South Sudanese live in rural areas. And essentially, they haven't benefited much from independence. Of course, there's a sense of feeling free, which is different, which is another thing. But in terms of roads, in terms of schools, in terms of health centres, they haven't benefited nearly enough. Partly, I think, the people who were in control of South Sudan's destiny after separation, quite simply, there's been lots of corruption. People who wanted to centralise power and resources, maybe as a consequence of long years fighting in the bush, once they had the opportunity to get this money, these resources, they used every opportunity to seize hold of it. They felt they wanted the rewards for their long struggle. And partly, I think, things like the oil shutdown, meant there were a lot fewer resources to go around because, quite simply, once they stopped the oil, 98% of government revenue went, and any hope of development, any hope of improving lives of people in rural areas in particular, just vanished.
And do you feel that for those reasons there is now a sense of disillusionment among many South Sudanese only 2.5 years after independence?
Yeah, and you know there are surveys, and I don't know how reliable they are, but suggest that a lot of people are still happy about independence. But even before this new fighting, they felt that the country was moving in the wrong direction. The SPLM's Luca Byong, who's now at Harvard University, has talked about the liberation curse, this idea that the people who bring a country to freedom, to independence, the liberators, are often not best placed to put in practice a more consensual mode of politics that you need once you're actually governing a country. And it hasn't just affected South Sudan, it's affected a lot of other places. But South Sudan is definitely paying the penalty for that now.
While you're writing the book, I think it was last year, you told me that its distinguishing feature was going to be looking at the interdependence between the two countries, rather than looking at South Sudan as the world's newest country, but also as North Sudan as a new state. Why was this perspective so important, and why were you so keen to involve more of a Northern Sudanese perspective?
Well, I think it's very difficult to understand South Sudan without understanding Sudan. And there's a risk now that they're separate countries of just looking at one or not the other. But actually, if you look at the period after separation, you realise just how connected the two are. So one of the people I talk about in the book, and it's an anecdote, but it gives you a sort of metaphor, if you will, for some of the continuing ties, is a doctor called Garang Thomas Dell, Southern Sudanese. He studied in Khartoum. He fell in love with a Northern Sudanese. He courted her for 10 years, and the family kept saying no because he was a Southern Sudanese. And eventually they got married. So the family gave in, and they got married. But then separation came. He's stuck in South Sudan. She's in Khartoum with their two children. He needs a visa to go and see his own children. So there are these continuing ties between the two, but continuing difficulties because of the relationship between the two countries. And actually what happens in Khartoum affects massively what happens in Juba and vice versa because of the links between the people on the borders, because of oil, which affects the economies of both countries because South Sudan, of course, exports its oil through Sudan, and because of conflict and support for rebel groups in each other's country. So I think it's vital, if you're interested in South Sudan, to follow Sudan and vice versa. And that's something I tried to do in the book.